Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation on renegadepopculture.com. If you like what we do, please consider liking, sharing, and following us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our podcast. We are everywhere. If you like what we do, consider supporting our Patreon at patreon.com/renegadepopculture. That way we can keep doing what we love, and that's talking about the world of animation. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And we got a pretty fun show for you tonight. We've got reviews for Iwaju, Invincible Season 2, and of course, as we always do, we have our indie spotlight, which honestly is a pretty fun one. Cameron, would you like to describe Ramshackle for our audience?
So Ramshackle is by the YouTuber Zedeezy. I think that's how you pronounce it. And it's about three orphans that live on the street. And then, well, we follow their shenanigans, with this first pilot being about them finding a baby that was abandoned in a trash can, that then it then turns into them taking the baby to be a part of this child beauty pageant, and well, things unravel from there. As mixed as I am on this pilot, I like it, but it's not my favorite indie pilot that I've seen amongst the indie pilots that we've talked about. I am happy that for once the indie animation fandom actually showed up, because as of right now, from its release 2 weeks ago, it has over 3 million views, which, we've been very much talking adamantly about how the indie animation fans who want to see indie animation be this vibrant ecosystem need to actually show up for the other pilots. Now, with all that said, I think this pilot has a fun art style. I like the looks of the characters. They got this nice cartoony stretchiness to them that I guess would say like has more of a rough Newgrounds look to it from the designs and the line work. But the backgrounds are great. And to be clear, the Newgrounds animation comparison isn't a negative. Not every pilot is going to look like it was funded by a studio, like from Cartoon Network or what have you. It comes off like a 1920s take on The Misadventures of Flapjack, just from the focus on like the ugliness of humanity and then just the deranged sections and moments and the final twist of what the baby actually is by the end of the runtime.
I don't want to spoil the twist for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, but given the view count, I'm pretty sure those who wanted to have already seen it. But still, this pilot has its like stupid moments, but I just found myself laughing at all the dumb sight gags and like the dialogue that I completely get the appeal of this one. I really hope it is a success because I see a lot of potential in this premise, in these characters, and if they're going to keep up this social commentary throughout however many episodes this lasts, I'm into it. I see the vision and I want to see Zendesi succeed.
I think my biggest problem with Ramshackle is more the world that it places us in. I get that, like, this old-timey 1920s world thing is very popular among indie animation series, whether it be like the Cannibal Town from Hazbin Hotel or the time period of Lackadaisy. I think it's like I'm getting a little tired of that setting, even though it's only shown up three times now. But it's like at this point, I wish there was something a little more interesting about the world than it just being in the 1920s or what have you. And as much as I did also laugh at the stuff, like the whole baby pageant moments and the whole sequence of That's just a baby. It can't win. And then the announcers are just like, oh my god, maggot won. He did the worm or the maggot. It's more like the commentary that it has is not very
subtle.
It's not very interesting to me. We've seen stories like this before about the people below wanting to get back at the rich who very much screw over everyone else and then frolic in their wealth and hedonism of being, you know, rich. It did win me over at the end with the twist of who Maggot, the little baby, is. But it's a good proof of concept of what we are going to expect from this world. I do like our three characters and their dynamic. I like the visuals. Like I said, I think the backgrounds look great. It's just tough because, well, you know, these indie pilots take a lot of time. And then by the time this came out, well, there's already been a lot of shows that have either took the extra steps to be more interesting or done something better that this one kind of fumbles with me. But I definitely want to see this do better because, you know, the pilot isn't always the end all be all of like, oh, this is exactly what the whole show would be like if it was able to continue. I want to see this go further. I want to see at least one more episode, and we'll have to see if that happens because, again, making a pilot that lasts 15 to 30 minutes is going to take a while when you do not have the backing of a studio or multiple people working on it with you. We'll just have to see what happens.
I am very happy that the pilot found an audience, and I hope they stick around to continue supporting Zedeezy and their whatever comes next.
Exactly, because we've talked about this where indie pilots can do really well, and some indie series can become a series. But since they don't have the support of a studio behind them, viewership is pretty much the driving force of making sure these shows can keep going. I think what happened was everyone saw the Lackadaisy, the Hell of a Boss, and the Amazing Digital Circus success happen to them, and then thought, hey, maybe we can do this also, and since we're an indie animation pilot or series, we're going to get all that same support, when that is obviously not the case. I love Monkey Wrench, but if y'all don't give that show the support that you give the Amazing Digital Circus, then stuff like that is not going to keep going. Even the Port by the Sea team was very much like, hey, thanks for watching our pilot. Who knows if we'll ever see more of this in animated form, because we need a lot of money to make more of these things. It's like the indie fandom doesn't quite get how, yes, it's not backed or being interfered with by a studio, but they need that money, man. Everyone needs that money. You can't just quit and go indie.
That's true.
And I hate that we keep having to bring this up, but yeah, that's what happens, man. You gotta show your support, either buying their merch, donating to their Patreon, or just simply sharing and liking and keeping the buzz around their shows alive.
It would be unrealistic to expect every single person to throw money at every single one of these pilots, but at least if you keep circulating these links and keep raising awareness, it will reach more people.
If they say, like, hey, we need funding for an episode 2, then show your support. You don't have to go for the highest tier of, like, a Kickstarter. You can just donate $5. And that's what I've done plenty of times. I've donated enough to either see the pilot early or just to say, like, hey, I like what you're doing. Here's some cash. And that's when I was able to. So while I'm mixed on it, I'm glad that Ramshackle has found its success. So give it a watch if you, for some reason, haven't seen it yet. I think people who like The Misadventures of Flapjack will enjoy this one. So next, we shall talk about Disney's big collaborative effort with the Pan-African entertainment company Kugali Media with the 6-episode limited series, Iwaju. which is a limited series that combines dramas, science fiction, and African futurism, where we follow two young kids who come from like entirely different regions of Nigeria and solve a mystery of something that is connecting the two of them together. And listen, I really like that something like this got made. I am so happy for the folks like Olufikao Adeola and for making this series get brought to life. And I love all the little details that we'll talk about when we expand more upon this show. I do think while it's great, something is missing about this series that's truly preventing it from becoming amazing.
I echo the same thoughts. I remember being really excited about this project when it was announced like almost 4 years ago. It was announced in December 2020 when Disney did their big like investor day thing. I remember being really excited for this because it is such a cool idea with Disney collaborating with...
The animation itself was done by CineSite from their Montreal and UK location. It's an important collaboration with the Kugali Media Company to bring more stories to life that take place in Africa and stars people from there.
Yes.
This was a very important and very big deal because back then they were also hyping up stuff like Kizazi Moto Generation Fire anthology series, where they had all the different shorts that were all done by talent studios and teams in Africa, because Africa really does have a good animation scene that we have actually seen before with studios like Triggerfish doing stuff like Seal Team or some of the recent shorts from the Star Wars Vision series. There is this Netflix series that Triggerfish did, Super Team 4. Let's talk about the positives of this. I think since the animation was done by CineSite as part of the co-production of this creation, maybe it's because that Disney was willing to give them like more money to do so, because I wouldn't say CineSite has made the best animated films and such around. Their animation kind of ranges from stuff like Gnome Alone, Charming, the Addams Family films, Paws of Fury. They did some help with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, some work with the Marvel What If series, and apparently are going to help out with the upcoming Smurfs movie that's coming out next year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I think it looks great. There are definitely some moments where you can feel the limitation of that studio's animation experience come through. But again, unless you are really into animation, you're not going to notice the wonky physics from here and there, or the maybe less than great texture work from time to time. But like I said, those are very minor issues. I think this is a very cool looking world that the artists were able to put together. And I like the human designs. I'm sure a lot of people will say they are simple, but they still are animated with a lot of expression and have a lot of personality to their designs and movements.
I like the human designs, but I think what I love the most about the series is the architecture, the technology. Even as generic of a design as Oten is, the lizard, it's still a cool concept that she's like this robotic protector of Tola. I think that concept is just really cool.
There's a lot of ambition with its storytelling, with the, like as it's described, the series explores deep themes of class, innocence, and challenging the status quo of how the poor and the rich live their lives, and how that vacuum between the two causes people who do not have the best intentions with them to take advantage of the poorer folks or one of the cities And like, there's a lot of cool stuff that this show wants to talk about, but boy howdy, I could not tell you exactly what the overall exact plot was, outside of there's a villain who kidnaps children, and one of the two children is connected to this child trafficking kingpin, and then how Tola's dad is very much ignoring the problems and everything going on with his life because he wants to focus on making the world a better place, but, you know, missing the forest for the trees, as they say.
I think that's as good a summation of this story as you're going to get. Diagnose the problem with the series is tricky because I'm not sure if this was always intended to be like a limited series and not like a movie at one point. It's not really paced like a television series, but at the same time, like, you don't really get a firm grasp on what the story is until like halfway through. And also, six episodes isn't enough time for fully developed character arcs and satisfying motivations.
There needed to be a better, or at least a stronger, through line, because even though like stuff happens, there's an issue of it feels smaller scale than it kind of comes off. Like, it seems like it's trying to be this big life-changing thing, but the story is very much focusing on Tola's connection with her dad and her friend Cole's wanting to get a better life for him and his mom. And I like that driving force. You know what? Maybe a lot of this is on the marketing of this series, because a lot of the marketing, or what little marketing that it got, was focusing very much on the lizard. Like, the lizard was going to be the big driving force of this, but really, the lizard plays such a little part in the overall limited series. I'm just wondering, like, what happened during the production for them to be like, focus on the lizard, we'll make that the selling point, and then give us, like, a pretty okay experience of the kids learning from one another about their respective worlds, and the rich actually doing something to help other people who are in less than stellar situations due to life and the economy, and, you know, what the cost of those riches come from. I don't really find all the characters all that memorable. I love the design for Bode de Souza. I thought Femi Branch did a great job with their performance, and I also liked Deo Okinyi. I like the voice cast in general, but I don't think these are exceptionally strong characters.
They had the potential to be strong characters, just from the performances of these voice actors to, I guess, the ideas that are established in the first episode. But again, I just don't think there's enough of a cohesive through line to connect all of these ideas together.
What happens is that we take, at the very least, of the six episodes, two episodes to set everything up. One episode follows Tola's life, and then the other one, we follow Cole and the situation there, and learn, honestly, more about our villain's backstory than the other characters. Like, we don't really know why the dad is so adamant about ignoring his own daughter, and what the importance of this lizard is. I don't want this to come off like I hate this series.
Not at all.
It's more the fact that it has so much going on, it had so much potential, but I feel like I got more out of the Kizazimoto experience than I did with Iwaju. from what I could find, it sounds like they didn't give this production too much time. Like, it was announced in 2020. The actual production started in 2022. Maybe they just didn't have enough time to flesh this out, or maybe because what this series comes off as is more of a proof of concept, a tech demo of what these collaborations could unfold if Disney decides to do more with the Kugali Media Company. It's good. It's solid. There just needs to be more to it, because by the end of it, I just felt like, so everything's good. The child trafficker Kingpin is arrested. He has revealed that he takes advantage of everyone's unfortunate situation to then be like, hey, I'll give you money if you do what I say. If we stop, we'll enjoy living on the streets again, or not getting your medicine or medication or solving whatever illness that you have. And I love like the music for this show. It's just wonderful. It's by Ray Olunuga. I do like how they, while it is mostly in English, they do put in elements of the Nigerian Pidgin and Yoruba language.
That was a cool touch.
It really does a good job with making you feel lived into this sci-fi world, and how they introduce small moments and elements like hawkers using mechs or small drone robots to sell stuff to people who are in like those flying cars and such. There just needed to be more to this. I would love to see more of Iwaju. I feel like what we got was a proof of concept for a bigger series. Like, yeah, that's cool, but it's also like, okay, but I feel like I'm missing a whole thing or element that would send this above and beyond it being a small limited series that Disney barely marketed for some reason.
Yeah, and then to add insult to injury, they just dropped the whole all six episodes at like towards the end of February, which on the one hand I understand, because like we mentioned, this isn't really paced like a TV show, so dropping all six episodes, I see why they did it. It just, they weren't really confident in what they had and just said, here you go.
Exactly. So hopefully if we see more of this, we can see them either expand on this world, or we see them craft a slightly more tighter narrative. I want to see more. A lot of these collaborations that Disney has done with other studios from around the world constantly put in, honestly, the most interesting things that they've ever put out.
Oh, yeah. I will still recommend, even if you don't care at all about Star Wars, Visions has like some of my favorite short segments in there.
I think a good takeaway from this is that collaboration will lead to much more creative storytelling, cool visuals from all these different studios, different stories from all these different creatives. It would be a good idea to keep investing into this idea, because people want to see something new. They don't want you to keep regurgitating the same old stuff for the sake of nostalgia, or playing it safe to hit the widest audience possible. Because, you know what they say, when you try to make something for everyone, you make something for no one. Like I said, if you haven't seen Iwaju, and understandably so, if you know you've missed the marketing from this or didn't realize it was already on Disney Plus, give it a watch.
Yes.
Because now we need to take a chill pill and recollect our thoughts and talk about Invincible Season 2. I will say this first. Some of y'all who got extremely mad at the fact that this second season got split into two parts because the team crafting this show that y'all apparently love so much needed more time, reacted so terrible about it. Like, oh my goodness. There was that one tweet from that one idiot that was like, this is why fighting for better working conditions ruins shows, because then I can't get what I want now. And it's like Jesus, buddy. Like, animation fans, you all kind of suck. Or at least this brand of animation fans sucks, because you know what? These are hour-long episodes full of really intricate writing, storytelling, and drama. If they need more time to craft the best experience of bringing Invincible to life, then you need to learn patience and be happy that you got such a good season to begin with. To have a show that brings so much discussion and voices to the world of superheroes in a time where superhero media is not crashing and burning, but hitting that ceiling where there is nowhere else to go. People are getting more sick of superhero movies now, and they want to see something different. To do something different, to really commit to subverting the superhero tropes, these teams need time.
The other thing that frustrated me about how people reacted to the break in between the two halves, that's nothing compared to how long Gravity Falls fans had to wait in between, like, the parts of Weirdmageddon, or DuckTales fans waiting like a year for the season 2 finale, or Steven Universe fans who have constantly been against the ropes with the way Cartoon Network has treated that show. So what if Invincible took a few months off to touch up a few things, make sure that they deliver quality television? Because, yeah, the show is... I gotta be careful qualifying my thoughts on this, because I do think season 2 is better than season 1 as far as superhero television so far this year. Right now, it's between this and X-Men 97, but we'll get to that when we get to that. For now, what did you think of the overarching plot of this season?
So let's get this out of the way also. Yes, season 2 was partially a, well, I hate to describe it like this, a quote-unquote filler season. And I said this in my editorial talking about the first 4 episodes, where the show really took its time to let viewers take a literal chill pill, because of season 1 was such a wild ride, and then that finale with the train sequence. Yeah, I think they knew everyone needed some breathing room before everything hit the fan again. So I understand that people feel like, oh, this is kind of like when My Hero Academia's villains took a back seat for one season for the Yakuza characters to take some time in the spotlight or what have you. I can understand how that this is how it feels, because we are, instead of dealing with some new big bad world-ending villain, we are dealing with a supervillain who is wonderfully played by Sterling K. Brown. And his character's name is Angstrom Levy, who is a scientist who also has the ability to create portals to other dimensions, and wants to get all of his versions of himself along with the, what are the two twins called again?
The Maulers.
Yeah, the Maulers together to help them, him make a world or like a universe or multitude of dimensions where there is no violence and Invincible is not, you know, going evil Superman on in every single universe. Unfortunately, things go awry, and even though it's mostly Angstrom's fault for ending up where he does, things turn out Not great for our buddy Angstrom, as he is then deformed with a mind and body that encapsulates all the memories of his, well, other dimensional selves, of the horrors that he had to see because of the Viltrumites essentially conquering Earth and killing everyone who could or may stand a chance. Essentially what the Viltrumites were supposed to do when Omni-Man was supposed to land on Earth and, you know, be like, hey, okay, everything looks good. Let's take it all over, and they will not stand a chance against us. But the main drive for this season is not really who's the next big bad. Because, I mean, we get that. We know what's going to happen with this third season. But the Viltrumites are not really the focus. And I know that sounds weird saying that because of what happens within the second half of this season, but it's more about everyone dealing with the ramifications and trauma of what happened within that first season.
Yeah, this is, if nothing else, this is kind of continuing the sort of coming of age story that Mark has been going through from the beginning, but specifically, he needs to figure out, like, who is he? Is he going to end up like his father? Or is he better than that? Is he above becoming a killer, so to speak?
That's really what's the driving force of everything, because we go through so much, including the fact that Mark's mom,
Debbie,
going to like a, how would you describe it? Like a superhero anonymous kind of meeting.
She's going to group therapy.
Yeah, for like people who have dealt with the trauma of losing someone due to them either being a superhero or dying because of an invasion. And like when she finds out that one of the people that she was almost befriending there was the husband of one of the superheroes that was killed in the very first episode of season one. I think it was the Green Ghost.
Yep.
Like the problem is she can't be in a normal world. She has now been connected with everything that Omni-Man has indirectly put her in the sight lines of. We have like the government, we have all the superheroes, the aliens. Then like when she finds out that, oh, my husband killed your fiance, it was like a breaking point of, I'm not going to be able to find comfort and peace in this world by just saying like, hey, it happened, whatever. You can't just be like, oh, I stubbed my toe. There's a lot more to it than that. We also see this throughout pretty much everyone. Everyone has like big or small character arcs here or there that end with pretty okay outcomes, and some having more, I mean, I guess you could say what happens to Jason Mantzoukas' character slightly better than what happened, but, you know, Rex Splode with, boy, howdy, was I not ready for what happened to him.
No, not even close.
Because I was like, you know, for a show that can get awfully violent, the violence was not so much of a thing with this season until the halfway point where they had to essentially fight a indirect parody of, oh, what is that cult in the DC universe that you see in like Batman Beyond and
the Cobra Society or whatever?
Yeah, that, or what they were. So, like, it's funny because Invincible has like their fingers in a lot of pies. So the parody could be like a mixture of things, like the Serpent Society or whatever this show's version of it is called, is like the Cobra Cult or whatever from DC, but it could also be like, you know, Cobra from G.I. Joe.
And that's what I love about this series, like, full disclosure, I never read the comic, but I know enough about it through cultural osmosis to know that, like, these are all original characters that comic book fans know that these are a bunch of copies of various characters from Marvel and DC, but the strength in that this being an original universe is that the stories can go to these ultra-violent extremes while still like having the freedom to tell its own story. This isn't just like a parody for the sake of being edgy.
And there are definitely some moments where it's like, it's obviously meant to be like a joke, where like when Mark is sent through a portal, he ends up in a world where it's it reminds me of that scene from Austin Powers where it's like, oh hey, that's Batman. And it's like, well, technically, since we don't want DC's copyright lawyers to come after us, it's not actually Batman. Yes, it's legally distinct Batman. Which they don't say that directly, but the whole like, so you wear this costume and it's based off of a bat, and your name is, short of saying it, he's like, isn't that kind of lazy? I don't know, man.
My favorite, though, is Josh Keaton actually voices a character named Agent Spider. In the comics, that is actually Spider-Man who Mark meets for a brief moment. But again, for similar legal reasons, they had to change it. But still, that they got Josh Keaton to voice him just kind of made that even better.
Talk about this one, for example, because this is one of those that has like, oh good, he's okay, but how okay is he? Question mark. Outcome of his arc. Because I mean, I remember when we talked about the first season, we were like, okay, you know what? As much as I love Jason Mantzoukas, the character that he plays here, Rex Sloan or Rex Splode, kind of the worst. I think we're almost at a breaking point of Mantzoukas turning up the unlikable dirtbag dial to 11, or beyond that. And he finds himself, along with a handful of heroes, having to take down the Lizard League. And not only does he sacrifice his hand to kill one of them, a Komodo dragon, after thinking that he killed another hero character, he gets, well, at first shot in the head. And then we think, essentially, what happens is after you think everyone died there, and it, golly, I was like, wow, they really went there. They just killed everyone off before they, said psych. Rex, I don't know how else to put this. Rex got lobotomized.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's directly that, but he, like, whatever part of his brain that got shot made him off. He was a lot nicer. He had other interests, and yet there was something off about him. And he knows that too. He's almost back to being his superhero self, but after a bit, he's like, he had second thoughts about his hero work. That's something that we've seen throughout this whole season, where we see robots or
Rudy.
and his relationship to Monster Girl change, and how he's still thinking logically as a robot. I mean, it's Zachary Quinto, who was also Spock in the Abrams Star Trek films.
One correction. Ross Marquand is the robot.
Just having to be more human and stop trying to solve every problem. Because Monster Girl, like, yeah, I know my power makes everything worse for me. It sucks, but I don't really want that to be how you identify me. That's been a big thing about this season, characters finding their own identity, like we said with Mark. Especially when you find out that when Mark goes to another planet to help this species out, yeah, guess who shows up? His dad. And we see the outcome of Omni-Man going from like a tyrannical individual who was just playing a facade of a loving, caring person until at the end when he of season one, where he was pretty much going to kill Mark and then flew off going who knows where and finding inner peace again with this colony, only for his actions and who he was as an individual beforehand coming back to bite him when the other Viltrumites find him and are like, hey, you know what? You didn't do your mission, so we're going to take you back, put you on trial, and then kill you because you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. Like I said, the Viltrumites are not the main driving force of this season, but they make sure to leave an impression with you. They show you exactly how cold and heartless they can be when they don't have those pesky things called human emotion.
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure how I was going to react to the TV version of Omni-Man after the events of season one, but seeing him in this season, especially in the second half, I can't wait to see his redemption arc continue to unfold.
We definitely learn more about the Viltrumites, especially when we are introduced to characters like Anissa or, oh, what's his name? The one who helps out Alan.
The guy voiced by Peter Cullen.
Thaddeus. So we learn about this one Viltrumite who lives amongst this, you know, galaxy. They're basically a United Nations, but for aliens. And we find out Thaddeus, who is voiced by the great Peter Cullen, a.k.a. Optimus Prime. And he tells Alan, who is, you know, once again, voiced by Seth Rogen, okay, we need y'all to solve this problem with these Viltrumites coming through and killing more people. It's funny how this show flips some of these characters, because in another comic or another series, Thaddeus would be a secret surprise villain. Because at first we kind of think he essentially killed Alan after Alan ran into a bunch of those Viltrumites. It was like, okay, so he's the big bad. I mean, who knows? I haven't read the comic. Maybe he does become the big bad. But when Alan gets the upgrade to be able to fend off against the Viltrumites, you know, very Dragon Ball Z-ish.
Yep. In Captain America, the First Avenger, where he gets like that super serum.
Exactly. He gets stronger so he can fight them. Thaddeus tells him that he is the very first Viltrumite to rebel against his own kind. And Alan, it's like, well, you know what? You're not the only one now. And it's very interesting where this story goes. And even like on the more human level, we find out more about the human character voiced by Chris Diamantopoulos.
Donald.
Yeah, we find out stuff like Donald, where, oh, he's actually a robot. And he's been brought to life and died multiple times. In a very, like, Venture Brothers way, before Venture Brothers killed off that part of the show. Like, metaphorically and literally. And we also see change with, yeah, Cecil. I was very much surprised about that, because Cecil, like, in the first season, was very much stone cold. He was not very emotive. He did not care about who got hurt. He was fine as long as people like Omni-Man or whatever major threat was taken care of by any means necessary. But here, he gets more of a human development. Like, he grows a heart. Let's just say that. Because after Mark gets back from space and brings back Omni-Man's new son that he had with the aliens, Debbie gets kind of like a new chance to help a new life grow into something that won't result in like what Mark or Omni-Man turned into. And Cecil becomes more supportive. Like, he lets his cold persona down. And I think that's great. There's like not really a whole lot of characters, I would say, who got the short end of the development stick.
Everyone had their chance to shine. Even Eve, who, A, had a special alter herself, so we didn't really get to see too much of her obvious reasons. She's kind of taking a break from the superhero life until she's needed for another mission in space.
I love that joke. Mark finally gets back home from space, and then like a day later, or just like a few hours later, hey, Mark, guess where you're going, buddy? I think that happens like 3 or 4 times throughout this whole season, and it's played up as a joke. And we also get to see more development with some of the superheroes, like the Martian that escaped Mars from the infestation, and
Shapesmith.
We also get some new characters like Bulletproof. I like these cast of characters, and I like that they even brought back Immortal, and we see him, like, what happens with essentially all those years being an immortal superhero. What happens to that? Like, what kind of mental state you are put into with the power of immortality? This does lead to probably my least favorite of this season. And I'm sure they can solve this with season 3, or they'll build up on it. It was the relationship between the Immortal and Duplicate. I get why Duplicate went for the Immortal. I mean, granted, I think there's a ickness to the relationship. I don't think they've lampshading the fact that there's definitely a difference of power between the two and literal age.
Do we actually know Duplicate's age?
I assume they're all like college age.
Minimum above 18.
It's the fact that we don't see a lot of their relationship. It's played up like as a middle finger to Rex, who, like, with his arc of becoming more emotionally vulnerable and open, it's just like, well, you know what? This guy gets me and you don't, so screw you. And I don't know if I like the idea of them pulling a fake death with Duplicate.
I want to see where that goes, because it does kind of lose the punch of what we think happens to her during that battle.
Like, what happens is that, like, during the battle with the Lizard League, she gets supposedly killed. Like, when Komodo Dragon finds, oh, this is how your powers work, so let me test the two of you together so you can't keep duplicating. Only to find out in the last episode that it's been her copies the whole time. Like, I don't think there's ever been a indication of she left the superhero work, but kept her copies going for the sake of there being some superhero to help out. I just don't buy their romance. Yeah, I just think there's something a little iffy about it. I don't think they're saying it's great. They're emotionally stunted in different ways, I guess. Oh, yeah,
for sure. Now, speaking of romance, we do kind of have to talk about Mark and Amber.
Well, where would you like to start with that? Because I swear the whole thing in the first season was, like, the whole discourse around that was annoying as hell.
Absolute hell waiting in that discourse pool. But in this season, I think what I like about their relationship is it kind of proves that it's not easy for either one of them. And they both know it. They know that on the one hand, they wanted to make it work for as long as they could, but I like that they understood that there is a lot of baggage that comes with the superhero life, that because of Mark's line of work, they don't get to see each other as often as they'd like. And that can be emotionally taxing. No matter how much you care for the other person, that's not an easy relationship to be in.
It's funny because, like, as action-packed as this show can be and how graphically violent it is, it's way more interested in the drama, the characters, because that's what's going to keep you coming back, and where a lot of recent superhero media has failed. People like these characters because they give them time to actually talk to one another, to interact, to grow as characters. That's what's great about it, because yes, it is funny when they show us like, oh, ha ha, here's this slight parody of whatever superhero or supervillain group from pop culture is here. Or it's like, oh man, his head popped like a balloon. It's more focused on what actually means more. Because if this was just another hyper-violent gore fest, people wouldn't have shown up for it. There's a reason why people keep showing up for stuff like The Boys. If The Boys was just this edgy, nihilist, gory take on superhero stuff without the aspect of how, like, big mega corporations, like, what would happen if they were, you know, the ones funding the superheroes instead of, you know, the superheroes doing, like, Invincible could have easily been one of those late 80s, early 90s anime OVA things where the plot in the world didn't really matter because you were there for the action and the blood and guts. But you are here less for the action and violence and more for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I know this sounds like it's the most straightforward thing possible, but it's like, how hard can this be to mess up? You can mess it up pretty badly.
Yeah.
Because nobody would have tuned in for this if it was just a superhero parody with violence.
I will say this, to tease our upcoming thoughts on X-Men 97, really the only difference between these two shows is because X-Men 97 is on Disney Plus, it doesn't go quite as hard with the blood and the guts and the hyper-violence, but both kind of have the same general storytelling philosophy of put the characters first, the action second, but also not too far behind.
And that's what's fun about superheroes, because you really would want to know a little bit more about them than just they wear these colors for their superhero suit and they punch really hard. And a good example of all this is when Mark has to go against Langstrom again, and how Langstrom, from his intention of making a world with no violence, ends up with him becoming a violent sociopath, willing to hurt a literal child to make Mark stop.
This is the best example I've seen recently of a villain who only sees himself as the hero. He's so wrapped up in his own agenda that he doesn't see the damage that he's caused, not just Mark and his family, but to himself.
Like, it's interesting because he doesn't quite see himself as the villain, even though it's Invincible is just trying to save the land. And yes, in your universe or other universe, Invincible became the bad guy, but that was because he essentially followed the Viltrumites' code of conduct. This is a universe where Mark does not have the influence of the Viltrumites breathing down his neck. He's really trying his best to save the world and to save everyone, to make sure that no one gets hurt or dies. But because Angstrom is so hellbent on getting rid of Mark, he can't see that. He doesn't even think about it. And he blames everything on Mark, even when it was his fault he became deformed.
Yep.
And by the end of it, we see Mark just not knowing what he needs to do or what he can do. Because Mark just hits a breaking point. He doesn't know where he can go, where he can be normal, where he can feel like an actual hero instead of a murdering sociopath like his father.
I like how the moment when he buries Engstrom 6 feet under, that moment is more towards the beginning of the episode so that the rest of the time can the audience can just like sit with what he's done and how he's going to move forward from that point.
There's a great scene in the final episode. Well, two great scenes that encompass all the growth that happens throughout this season and through the show so far, where Mark is talking with his mom and the mom and Debbie is just like, you know, maybe you just go back to school, go to classes. And Mark is just like, I can't find this balance anymore of trying to be a superhero and being a normal person and being someone who does not kill or needs to kill to stop a threat. He was put through the ringer this season. He was not really able to deal with the trauma of what the first season dropped on him. And instead of having time to just let everything else happen without him, he had to continuously keep moving and to keep helping, keep saving people, whatever. And it's sad. Like, it's extremely sad.
He never really gets a break. Everything from his fight with Omni-Man to all the shit he's had to deal with, like, it's a lot for him to process, and he never gets that time.
And then with Omni-Man, when he's talking with Alan, and how he just comes to the conclusion that he doesn't want to be a Viltrumite, he doesn't want to be a violent dictator. It's like he found a way to remove the murder bug from inside his brain to become human. And at the end, he's like, I miss my wife. I don't want to be here. I want to be back there with her, with my family, live a life that's more worth living. And unfortunately, he is now stuck in a situation where he might get killed. But luckily, through a very creative means, we do find out that the Viltrumites actually do have weaknesses. They're not just unstoppable murder machines. I love that little detail of like, wow, really? I'm going to find this, the answer to the situation through all these popcorn pulp 50s sci-fi books that my dad wrote? Okay, let's see what happens. I love that little bit of world building.
That was a cool touch. And speaking of cool things like that, I had seen this scene out of context before I saw it in the episode, but that moment where at the comic convention where Mark goes up to the creator of Seance Dog, they do that whole lampshading of cutting corners in animation.
Yeah.
That moment was priceless. And the fact that it is like an actual adaptation of the panel from the comic where they have like a similar gag, it's just perfect.
I love that scene. And I know it's either going to be like, when I saw that, I told you, animation fans are going to respond in two different ways. They're either going to love that panel, or the other ones are going to be like, are they making fun of us for complaining? And it's like, you can say the answer is yes to both. It's a great insight to the world of animation, and it's telling animation fans to chill. Animation is time consuming. It's not done in a day.
Exactly.
I also love the little joke of, and I totally forgot about this gag from the first season, where an archaeologist finds that tomb in Egypt, like before the whole Pharaoh's plague and ruination can come to life, it gets like suddenly closed up again. I love that they actually went back to that in season two, where you see the two archaeologists walk in and the cursed Pharaoh character entity is just like, now I will pick a host from you. I can't pick the two of you. And they're like, why not? Is it because we're women? I need a male host to rule this new world. And then they just kind of lampshade that whole thing by Mark going through his anger, flying right by it, closing up the tomb again. That is like the most unluckiest Egyptian curse that I've ever seen in a piece of media.
I'll be honest, I forgot about that gag the first season, but I hope he comes back once every season just for him to have his coffin closed again.
This show does a good job with balancing out drama, action, and comedy. It can be very funny when it wants to be. And I think it choosing its moments to be funny make those jokes more impactful. I don't really have much else to say. It's a very good second season. I know it's a filler season. I get why people felt underwhelmed because they're going to say nothing happened when it's just more buildup for what's going to happen in season 3. And then with the recently announced season 4 and 5, we got plenty of time here. These are hour long episodes. We're probably going to get 8 of them each season and let them cook.
Just as a reminder to those who have read the comics or perhaps didn't even know this was based on a comic, this had 144 issues. So this show can go as long as it needs to. And I hope it does, because it's some of the best examples of superhero storytelling that I've seen in this visual medium.
It's probably something that helps with the overall medium of superhero stuff. I do think you probably just, not to say I don't want to see an Invincible movie, but I kind of don't now. I kind of want to see TV shows for the superhero stuff, because you're able to do more. You're able to flesh everything out. And yes, while that hasn't always worked out, I know not everyone is a fan of all the Marvel stuff that came out last year or like the last few years. There are definitely pros and cons to being a show and or a movie. But what we need to see more of is character building, a focus on story and character, not just action, not just setting up a bigger universe, not just winks and nods to other parts of the franchise. Just focus on the characters. Then you can worry about everything else after. Make a compelling story first. Hell, anime gets away with a lot of that all the time, where the animation's not great or the story's familiar, but with its focus on characters and world building, you're dropped into a world where it's like, yeah, I want to see more of this place. And that's what I come out of Invincible with every time. I want to see more of this world. That's really it for here. I'm not entirely sure what we're going to talk about next. I think if possible, we will talk about Spy X Family Code White, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I am excited to see that movie because, to be honest, it's the excuse I need to finish watching the anime. Even though I've heard the movie is like not necessarily canon to the anime, I still just want to finish because I love those first couple episodes.
No, it's one of those shows that I want to watch more of. I'm actually restarting my watch of it right now so I can go in, even though, yeah, technically most franchise films aren't going to alienate you enough. There hasn't really been a time of, oh, you need to actually watch the show before you watch the movie. Most of the time, you could just drop in and be fine. We'll have to see what happens.
But until then, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Cam's Eye View. I have my own website called camseyeview.biz, where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/camseyeview. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on various social media sites at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and that place at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser. Consider supporting our Patreon at patreon.com/renegadepopculture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. You can escape, so do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.